So these are the stories that, well, you need to know about today.
There is an enormous sensitivity around Israel being the homeland of the Jewish people. Can asking questions, though, stir up hate? I mean, language is powerful.
Putin's security has been heightened, with Russia's leader becoming even more reclusive. He's rarely seen in public and spends weeks at a time in bunkers.
The U.S. is not going to see supply outages. The risk of supply outages in other parts of the world is much higher than it is here in the U.S.
You're going to see those stories. Also, an interview with a podcaster you will not want to miss. As a podcaster, she's one part America's sweetheart, two parts tough and smart. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you for being there. And I want to thank you for being part of the 10 to 20 million people who are watching us every single week all over the world. And it's very, very much appreciated. There's a saying I hear in this building all the time. It's written on the walls, as a matter of fact. In fact, it goes beyond that. It's the ethos of this news organization. And it suggests that good journalism is about questioning more. Questioning more. I think that's spot on. Unfortunately, it's the opposite of what they do in a lot of places like the BBC, Fox, CNN, NBC. There, I can tell you from experience, because I worked there, you're encouraged to question less. Sometimes you're encouraged to not question at all. And by the way, those places, they all cherish the New York Times, right? It's like their standard bearer. It's also something, this little bit of a secret I'm going to share with you here. It's where they get all of their stories. They read the New York Times, and then they just copy the story, and they make a news report out of it, and a TV news report out of it. And that's why, when I saw this video, I wanted to share it with you. Watch.
You were pressing him on if the modern state of Israel as a homeland for the Jewish people today has legal or biblical legitimacy. You were sort of questioning him on this idea. And you went round and round on this for quite some time. And I was just wondering what you were trying to get at there.
I was trying to get at an answer.
There is an enormous sensitivity around Israel being the homeland of the Jewish people and the attempt to delegitimize that.
I have enormous sensitivity about the United States being the homeland of my people and the burial place of my ancestors.
Can asking questions, though, stir up hate? I mean, language is powerful.
Can asking questions then stir up hate? It's going to make people feel bad, so maybe you shouldn't ask them. That's a New York Times reporter suggesting to Tucker Carlson, maybe warning Tucker Carlson, maybe a better way of saying it, that he should not ask certain questions, especially when it comes to Israel. Think about it. Stop and think about what you just witnessed there. This is the friggin' New York Times telling a journalist with the biggest audience in the country, bigger than hers by a mile, that certain questions should simply not be asked because it might be sensitive to some people. They might get offended. Which questions? I mean, I'll tell you which questions Mr. Carlson has been asking lately. I know because I watch his show and because I talk to him regularly. So here's the questions Tucker Carlson asks. You probably know this if you listen to him. Why do Americans have to send hundreds of billions of dollars to Israel? Why do U.S. soldiers have to fight and die in Israel's wars? Why are Israel's donors, who are, by the way, Israeli citizens, allowed to bribe 94% of the people who work in the Congress of the United States? Is that not a good question? Here's another one. How come they're allowed to give the president of the United States hundreds of millions of dollars? Oh, and after they give him that money, what do they expect for it in return? There's more questions, but here's probably the most important question. Why is Israel slaughtering innocent people, including women and children? By the way, some of the people in the United States who ask those questions, they're threatened, they're punished, they're arrested, they're deported, they're demonetized, or they, you know what they get? I know, because I've gotten this. They get something that may be even worse. They're branded with what has long been considered America's scarlet letter. It's the mark of anti-Semitism, and you got to live with it. And it usually means you can't get a job and a lot of other things. Carlson has so far survived the onslaught, but the New York Times wants him to stop. You have to stop, Tucker Carlson. You can't ask those questions. No, it's too sensitive. Should he stop? What do you think? I want to give you some more information now about this, because in case you're still not sure how to answer the question that I just asked, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you the opposite of what Mr. Carlson is doing. Here is an unquestioned narrative with which you are probably familiar. You know the anti-Russia stories? They're everywhere. They spring up all the time in corporate media. They spew them on a daily basis without ever asking the what, the where, the when, the who, or the how. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. Watch this.
The Kremlin is increasingly concerned about the safety of Russian President Vladimir Putin. According to a report by European intelligence obtained by CNN, Putin's security has been heightened, with Russia's leader becoming even more reclusive. He no longer visits his holiday houses, hasn't toured military facilities this year, is rarely seen in public, and spends weeks at a time in bunkers.
He's hiding, huh? Weeks at a time in bunkers, you say? My goodness. Wait, let's, you know what? I just thought we should do something. She says that's Putin's bunker. Wow, did you see that? Hey, Gene, do me a favor. Can you show me that again? I want to see that again. I want to see Mr. Putin's bunker, where she said he's hiding out here for like, look at that. That's Putin's bunker. That's where he's been hiding out for the last 2 to 3 weeks, right? It's where he spends all of his time. It's just like, they report, this is news. They report this to the world. I mean, where did they get that? That's like exclusive video, I guess, right? Maybe, oh, I know. They got it from that lady who was asking questions of Tucker Carlson. They got it from maybe the New York Times. I mean, you see how laughable this crap is? I mean, if you just sit back and look at it, you don't know whether you want to laugh or throw up. There's nothing in this report that she just said, right, that is verifiable, even in the slightest bit confirmable. Nothing. And this woman, by the way, her name is Ursula, who's obviously reading a teleprompter and was not exactly hired for her inquisitiveness. She never once stops to ask. And neither did her editors, who say, hey, read this, right? Putin's hiding. We got exclusive information that Putin's hiding somewhere in a bunker that looks like that. Literally, none of what she said is properly sourced, no less double sourced like we're taught in journalism school to do, or even confirmable. It's innuendo. It's an obvious narrative planted by institutions with an axe to grind to make people in the United States and in Europe, and in this case, I guess, Australia, wherever the hell she works, dislike Russia and dislike Putin. And there's nothing new about this. And it kind of pisses me off. Not because I'm here to defend Putin. That's not my job. What makes me angry is the constant schlock that passes for journalism these days in the West. I mean, a journalism student in her first semester of the most basic news writing 101 class is taught that if a story smells like it's planted by somebody with an axe to grind, you should question it. Ask questions. Give context. Check the damn source. By the way, should we check the source here? So where do you think she got, a news organization got this from where? A well-placed source inside Mr. Putin's office or something like that? Inside it? No. Here, listen to where she got it. Listen.
According to a report by European intelligence obtained by CNN. By CNN.
She got it from CNN. CNN! Are you freaking kidding me? CNN? CNN is a reliable source when it comes to information about Russia. Since when? I mean, who else maybe could have she gone to get worse information? Rachel Maddow? So there's this huge announcement that just came out yesterday that many have missed, but I think you should know about it. It was a comment made by a man who runs one of the biggest oil companies in the world, Chevron. So he says, because of the Israel and U.S. war against Iran and what's happened and what we explained to you yesterday, the story that I went up and detailed on the map for you, explaining how both sides are now shooting at each other once again, the world might be on the verge of one of the worst fuel shortages that we've seen in 60 years, maybe 70 years. Now, this is a warning that's important. This is a headline in a lot of different places. We grabbed this story. This is Reuters, by the way. The chairman and CEO of Chevron's name is Mike Kirby. He's sounding the alarm because while President Trump, his advisors, and many in media are saying, oh, this war is very necessary and it's going to be over very soon, no big deal. The guy who really understands this stuff, really understands energy, he's saying, nope, that's not true. He's saying, not so fast. See, according to him, we may soon be looking at an oil shortage worse than the one that was experienced in the 1970s. I got the receipts here. I got the pictures to show you. Look at this. These are images of what happened back then. Gas stations shut down, out of gas. People lined up for miles to buy whatever gas they could find. Many pushing their cars the rest of the way after running out. I mean, this is horrible. I remember my dad waking up at like 3 o'clock in the morning. I remember my mom getting up to make him coffee because he had to go get in a car and look for gas 3-4 hours before he went to work in a factory. Oil prices quadrupled back then. Gas was rationed. People began panic buying, which made the situation worse. Economies declined from high inflation. Food prices shot up. Unemployment reached record heights. So here's, you know, that's why I think this is important, right? It's like, remember what we talked about earlier with this New York Times thing? The source, who's the source? You know, is it some schlag or is it somebody who really knows something? This guy, I think, knows something. He's a CEO. CEO Kirby is telling Bloomberg yesterday the same thing, sort of. I watched his interview. Here's how he describes what he says is already taking place in the world.
The real thing is the U.S. is not going to see supply outages. We're starting to see risks of supply outages in some of these economies. In Europe, you're seeing flights canceled and schedules reoptimized because jet fuel is getting very, very tight in Europe. We've seen a number of economies in Asia that have instituted policies to reduce demand because they're concerned about running out of supply. Countries like Australia that have shut down most of their refining capacity and are heavily dependent upon imports are taking measures to address that. So I think the U.S. is going to see the price pressures. It's a global market. These prices are set in global commodity markets, but the risk of supply outages in other parts of the world is much higher than it is here in the U.S.
Which is interesting that he says that, by the way. He's saying, and he went on, if you listen to the whole thing, we're not going to make you listen to it, but it's all over the place and you can find it. He says it's tough, and it's especially tough in the places where people are very poor. You know, in different parts of the world, Southeast Asia, et cetera. And he goes and he explains one by one what's happening to them now, not in the future. And that's why he says it's going to get much worse. He also says that the United States is not going to be hit as hard because, well, the United States has plenty of oil, right? There's some places that are going to be fine. Russia, for example, which also has plenty of oil. But actually, what he said about the United States is really not true at this point anyway. Maybe it's good, true for him. This guy's very wealthy, obviously. He's the CEO of a big company. He drives around in a limousine. I don't think he has to worry about the price of gas, nor does he have to look for gas, right? But for most Americans right now, the pain is already there. They're feeling it. They're paying, in some places, $5, $6, even $7 a gallon. And there doesn't seem to be any relief in sight. That's pain. People are being laid off. Large companies are already going out of business. Look at these numbers. And look at the case of what just happened with Spirit Airlines, the large, big yellow planes that have become so familiar to so many Americans for their discount fares. My family uses it. That's how we bring the kids home from college when we have our holidays and stuff. You know, my sons who are in Ohio and Tennessee, we fly them down on Spirit because it's a good deal and it's a pretty good airline, or was. It didn't survive Mr. Trump's war. This popular discount airline announced it's completely shutting down operations. The reason? It's pretty simple. It just couldn't afford. the increased fuel prices. Just can't afford it. Can't pay it. It can't pay that price and still be able to afford to put people on the seats based on the fact that they were giving people discounted fares. And it's not like a first-class service thing where people could pay through the nose. It wasn't. So it's Spirit Airlines is now selling its jets. It's out of business. So the question now is this. How many others are going to follow? Joining us now to talk about what's going on is an American podcaster who is a mix of Southern, Republican, pro-America values, and very smart. Mel Witte co-hosts a podcast that is called Previously Prohibited. And she's good enough to join us now to talk about some of these things. Hey, it's so great to talk to you. I'm so glad you're there.
Yes, can you see me? Am I in the frame?
Not only are you in the frame, but can I say, without getting in trouble, you look marvelous.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you.
So let's start with... Yeah. Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
No, thank you for having me. That's it. I just, I'm like cut off, so... I'm going to focus just on you. So I just wanted to make sure I was in the frame.
We got 10, 20 million people who are watching us right now all over the world. I don't want you to get nervous about it, but I just want them to hear what a true Southern North Carolina accent sounds like. Okay.
Yeah. You have to maybe give me a couple glasses of wine for that to really come out.
My wife is a Southern gal. She's from Moultrie, Georgia, tiny little peanut town in the middle of Georgia.
Yeah.
So we've only been married for 36 years, so I'm kind of beholden a little bit to the whole Southern culture. You know what's interesting is I was reading about you and looking at some of your work. You and I come from very different places in many ways. And I think we've both ended up at the exact same place in terms of how we see the world. And what I mean by that is I think you're a, and I don't want to describe you, you should describe yourself, but I know I came up kind of more on the liberal side, worked for CNN, worked for NBC, always, you know, fighting for the little guy, thinking, you know, Republicans are big, bad people. You came up on the Republican side thinking, you know, Democrats are probably kind of loony and all that. And now people like me and you and Tucker and so many others are kind of adjoined in America. I'm seeing kind of a coming together of America. Do you see that too?
Oh, absolutely. I think... everybody's gotten a lot better at identifying the problem, right? The problem is the corruption of our government, the way that big business has been able to infiltrate and now just controls the entire government, pulls all of the strings of both parties. And so I think the first step is actually agreeing on the problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, there's still some space, obviously, and sometimes in some places there's big spaces between how do we solve that problem. But what I've seen and what I've experienced, especially in the kind of post October 7th world, is that there are a lot of people from both sides have just decided that, you know what, we're seeing very clear lines of right and wrong being drawn. And you simply can't side with the people who are, you know, carpet bombing civilians. It's just wrong.
Yeah, I'm almost, you know what I'm almost thinking as I'm sitting here talking to you, like you and I are sitting around having a glass of wine or maybe a cup of coffee, is that we almost owe Mr. Trump a favor. Not because of what he's done that is right. In fact, I think what he's done is very wrong. But sometimes when you offer something to someone and then you take it away, now they know what it could have been. Are you following me here? He promised America first and then delivered everybody else but America first. And now we know what America first maybe could have been if we're just for a little while, people like you and me, maybe coming at it from different positions, dreamt, felt, tasted what America first could be. And then we had it pulled out from under us. And maybe that's bringing us together. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the thing is that populism, a lot of populist ideas, that is what Trump, you know, came down the escalator as a populist. That's what he rode to victory, his, you know, just kind of stunning victory in 2016 on populist ideas, jobs, secure borders, putting more money back in your pocket, focus on America first. We have to pay attention to our own people first. And, you know, to his credit, the first couple years of the administration, he did okay. He didn't, yeah. It wasn't terrible. You know, he wasn't able to deliver on everything that he said, but we could tell he was trying. He was clearly being obstructed by his own party. And then COVID happened. And COVID kind of like threw everything. And, you know, there was lots of excuses. And I have a lot of mixed feelings about Trump on COVID. But regardless, we were trying to get that back. And it seemed like the country really wanted 2018 back, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to go back to 2019. And I think a lot of people wanted to do that, left and right. And, you know, the Biden administration just ran a terrible campaign. Kamala was an awful candidate. Mm-hmm. Biden was an awful candidate, obviously. Yeah. And so it was a pretty smooth sailing victory. Now, what we have gotten since January 2025,
yes.
I don't think anybody could have predicted how awful it would be. I didn't expect the moon and stars. I had actually pretty low expectations, and I cannot believe how terrible things have gone.
Well, you know, it's funny to hear you say that, because you strike me as someone who is like the perfect demographic. If somebody were drawing somebody who somehow the Trump campaign had pulled over to their side, it's you. You're a woman. You're smart. You're a business person. You're Southern. You have all the things that Trump needed to pull over so that he could win the election. And I don't know who you voted for, but I bet he got you.
Yeah,
he got you.
He did. I voted for him three times. So I'm the one who in 2020 I sat outside volunteering for my GOP, my county GOP. I sat outside the voting center, the polling centers, handing out flyers every day for two full weeks for early voting. So
did you think in your wildest dreams, did you think that this guy would, you know, he's our president, and I have to be careful with my words, but I'm very disappointed. And it almost looked like, I'll say it, did you expect he would sell out the way he has to Israel and to donors and to so many other, you know, to big pharma, to the guys in the military industrial complex who want these wars, to big tech? I mean, my God, I could go on and on. But did you think that would happen?
No. And again, I'm pretty realistic. I wasn't expecting, you know, I could even see like this, the big tech crap. I could see that, because we saw that with COVID, how easily he just kind of just goes along with this stuff. I think a lot of times he doesn't understand a lot of what they're saying or doing, and he doesn't want to seem like he doesn't understand. So he just, okay, goes along with it. But the one thing I really just knew, and this honestly was the reason I voted for him in the very beginning, the one thing I knew for sure was he wasn't going to start any wars. I knew that in my gut, right?
Yeah.
And
oops.
So yeah. Yeah. it's and so that's been rough, I think. And you know, a lot of people will say, well, you should have known. And it's like, actually, you know, I have one, we had Kamala Harris. She was literally campaigning with Liz Cheney. Okay. Dick Cheney's daughter. They're sending, the Biden administration is sending cargo planes full of bombs and weapons to Israel once every 12 hours on the mark for over a year. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're all in. They're bought in.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got Trump on the other side saying, I'm not going to start any wars. I won't go to war with Iran.
Right.
That was his brand. It was literally his brand.
No. Listen, you made a logical choice. I mean, what represents the war machine more than the last name Cheney? I don't care what first name you put in front of it.
Yeah.
So
nothing.
You know, your mother used to tell you, I'm sure, show me who you hang around with and I'll tell you who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and Joe Biden was, he did the whole Democrat thing where they kind of wrap it in like feel good platitudes, like, oh, we're watching Israel and we're going to, you know, don't do that. If you guys do that, we're going to, you know, you're going to get your plane load in 14 hours instead of 12. You know, he did the whole plot, whereas Republicans just embrace the kind of, you know, macho, we got to destroy everything thing. And then Trump was just over here. And, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I paid attention very much in 2023, 2024 through the primary and whatnot. Yeah. And he was very tame, mild. He didn't say anything about the war from October till, well, he came out in the early days and said, oh, something's not right here. I don't think that they're being honest about how this happened. He got in a lot of trouble for it, and he didn't speak again on it until March of 2024. And so that's like 6 months. And so whereas everybody else was like, we have to give Israel everything, anything they want. We must be there for them. We have to, you know, I don't know if you remember Nikki Haley saying, if Israel wants it, then we give it. No questions asked. Yeah,
I remember very well. She said it during the convention, too.
Which was yes. Like, what in the world is going on here? That was, and Trump wasn't doing that.
How is that playing in North Carolina? What are North Carolinians, what are Tar Heelers thinking about this, and especially the Israel part? I'm curious. What are you hearing?
So I actually live in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is right next to Fort Bragg, which is the largest military base in the world. And so I have a very kind of up close in, you know, experience, I guess you could say, with members of our military and whatnot. Obviously, I'm in the minority around here as far as, you know, very much pro, like the pro-Palestine side or anti-Israel side.
Yeah.
I always just say I'm just America first. I just think, you know, I try to be a good Christian, a decent human being. But mostly I just stand with America. I don't actually stand with any other country or anything like that. Yeah, I would never say, oh, I stand with Israel or, oh, I stand with Palestine. That's not me. But I'm extremely sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. And so, you know, I have like T-shirts and stuff like that that I wear sometimes. And I have been shocked at the response. Like, I've never had a negative response to any of it. Never had. And I'm very outspoken. And never had anybody in real life, you know, people disagree with me, certainly.
Yeah.
But get upset with me? No. And now that we're in the war, now it's different. Now people are like, okay, I finally see what you're talking about. You know?
Yeah. When it hits home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because I've been calling this war, you know, I called this war, if Kamala had won or Biden, you know, I said, the goal is Iran. Iran is that's the, you know, that's the prize. And they're not going to stop until they get it. And I've long been of the opinion that what has been done in Gaza is so horrific on a scale that you and I can't imagine. It's just impossible for us to conceptualize, because they haven't allowed international journalists in. They've been able to, you know, the documentation done by Palestinians on the ground, they've been able to dismiss as propaganda or, you know, always downplay it. But I've been of the opinion that it's so bad in Gaza that they actually do need a very large scale war with lots of destruction to kind of offset that, right? Because if they don't get that, if they don't get massive destruction in Iran and whatnot, or and even what they're doing in Lebanon, I think, ties into, well, this is just the way that wars are fought kind of thing, right? I'm personally of the opinion that there are hundreds of thousands of people who have been killed in Gaza. I don't even think it's physically possible to drop as many bombs as they have.
And only kill 80,000, yeah.
Right, yeah, those numbers have barely budged in about a year. And of course, that's just, you know, we're only getting confirmed reports of, you know, death from actual physical violence, you know, the bombs and whatnot, as opposed to, you know, how many deaths have occurred from malnutrition, from, you know, starvation, from the just the stress of, you know, being in a killing zone for 2.5, almost 3 years now. So it's just going to be astronomical, and Israel's reputation will not survive. They will not survive.
I don't think so either. I think they're in a really, really bad place right now.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you're talking about probably a lot of your neighbors and stuff. And I do see that, too. I mean, look, I mean, you and me and everybody else, I grew up in South Florida. You grew up in probably in the Carolinas. My wife grew up in Georgia. But all of us basically receive the same message. You got to hate on all Islamic people. All Muslims are fanatical or whatever words they use to describe them. And you got to love Israel no matter what with all of your heart because we're all Judeo-Christians. I don't know when they stuck Judeo in front of Christian because I'm not a Judeo-Christian. I happen to be Catholic, which makes me a Christian. And that doesn't mean I have anything against anybody, but when did we start changing the vernacular in the United States where everything had to be for the chosen people and all Christians who were evangelical had to believe in Israel and we had to change our name to Judeo-Christian instead of just Christian? How did that all come about and why did we all buy into it so much? And are we now seeing it differently?
Yeah, so I actually have done a lot of research into Christian Zionism because, like you said, I grew up in North Carolina, and I never heard any of this stuff. I never heard of Christian Zionism as a kid growing up. I went to a Methodist church, and no one ever told me that I had to bless Israel to be blessed. No one ever talked about Jews at all. which is something that's funny. I always tell people, you know, I never knew any Jews. I've maybe met five in my whole life. There's just not a lot around.
In Miami, we had more than five. I can guarantee
you that. Right. So I never really had an opinion on them, or it just wasn't a thing that anybody ever talked about. You learned about the Holocaust, and that's about it. Right. So when I came into like Republican politics and whatnot, the Israel lobby, that I first became aware of its power in 2012. And I was a little surprised by how powerful it was. And I did think that, well, what becomes frustrating if you're a Republican is that Republicans are slavishly devoted to the Israel lobby. It is. And there's really nothing that they won't sacrifice. There's no domestic agenda priority that Republicans will not sacrifice if it means securing something for Israel or the Israel lobby.
Wow.
And
think about what you just said. Think about what you just said. There is nothing they will not sacrifice for Israel.
And no policy position that they will not bend the knee on. And so Democrats weaponize this against Republicans all the time, right? All the time.
But Democrats are just as bad, but Democrats also.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a uniparty.
It is. And because they're going to vote for it, but it just becomes this thing they get to use against Republicans. And we see this all the time. I made a long thread once, which I did, you know, just several examples of actual policy or like budget compromises that were made to ensure that funding went to Israel. Right. So, but I used to try to do the whole, well, you know, they're our ally, they're a good ally, but we should treat them as every other ally kind of thing. I don't like this kind of slavish devotion that these politicians are always putting on. That it grosses me out. And so, but then October 7th happened, and it was about 5 days after October 7th that Israel posted that they had dropped 6,000 bombs on Gaza in 5 days. And something snapped in me. And I was just like, I'm done. I'm done with this.
Interesting.
These people. So I started really looking into this, like, why? Where does this come from? And I've actually gone all the way back. I've traced it all. And I write threads on it. If you go on my X page, you can find me. I'm the Village Crazy Lady.
Yeah, I know. It's a very popular, it's a very popular X page, by the way. I spent this morning reading it.
Yeah, if you go into my highlights, you can find where I've done this. But what happened is that U.S. support for Israel up until, all throughout the Cold War, from its formation all through the Cold War, was actually rooted in anti-communism, right? Yeah. So that's where the whole idea of, like, they're the only democracy in the Middle East comes from. That's number one. That was the line that was sold to us. And if you go back and you look at even so there's this pastor, he was very famous at the time. He was the first mega church pastor probably in the world. His name is Frank Norris, and he was out of Dallas, Texas in the early 30s. And he's actually the guy who kind of, quote unquote, convinced Truman to recognize Israel. So he wrote him a personal letter. Truman responds and whatnot. But he in there, he, you know, he says this is the Jews' land and whatnot. But he doesn't refer to any of the like eschatology that we associate with Christian Zionism, which is like we got to get all the Jews back to Israel so Jesus will come back, right? Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He doesn't talk about any of that at all. So I was very curious about where does this come from, that, you know, we have to bless Israel. He doesn't make any references to that in his his appeal is more so that I was like, okay, well, that's our starting spot, Israel getting forum, and we've got on record, we've got this quote unquote Christian Zionist, but he's not using any of the arguments that they use today. So where does this come from? And what is called is it's premillennial eschatologies and times thinking, and it's dispensationalism. Do you want me to keep going on this?
Sorry. I think it's fascinating, yes. In fact, I had a guest on my show recently who was telling me all about this, and she stood up to the Trump administration and was fired because she was on the religious board, as a matter of fact, as you probably know, Carrie. Right. And she went through this
Carrie's
whole
great.
Thing. Yes. Yeah, Prajan.
Yeah.
She went through
right.
this.
So, but the thing that people have to remember is that dispensationalism did not actually become like a real big thing in our politics until after the wall fell, because genuinely, and I've been through State Department cables, Near East State Department cables, this is never referenced. These big advocacy groups like Christians United for Israel, the Philos Project, Christian Pastors Congress for Israel, something like that. All of that's a 2000s invention. All of that stuff. Christians United for Israel didn't even re-register or get registered until 2006. So when the wall falls, obviously Israel still wants the money. They still need the money, and they really start leaning into this eschatology. And they had actually been building up a man named Jerry Falwell for quite some time.
Yeah.
They brought him on board in the early 80s. And at the 1995 CPAC convention, there is this alliance formed between the Israel lobby and conservative power brokers, essentially.
But here's a question. Here's a question, because everything you're saying is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, if I'm one of these pastors, right? And I can understand they were able to get one or two or fascinated them, or maybe gave them a free ticket to go to Israel and they took their families. And that's nice. And okay, you win people over by doing something nice for them. But it looks to me like this was a vast effort where thousands mm-hmm. of pastors were not just visited upon or invited. No, they were recruited. And according to, I don't know as much perhaps as you do, but I understand from some of the readings that I have done that they were more than just recruited. They were paid. They were maybe even bribed.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why. Is that the case?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So these pastors get, they get grants for their churches. They get a lot of them are, in fact, supported by U.S. I'm gonna choose my words carefully. So USAID,
yes.
Which is they used to support a lot of the efforts of these via missions, right?
So are you saying? By the way, the USAID is tied to the CIA. So you're saying money mm-hmm. from the USAID, which is taken from my taxes and your taxes, was used to pay some of these pastors for what they did?
So absolutely, the USAID has sponsored missions
around
the world. And so that's what they do. It's through missions. And
wow.
Now the CIA used to use missionaries all the time. And they got caught in the 1970s. And then George Bush Sr. was the director of the CIA at the time that this happened. And he promised they would stop doing that. unless... they would stop asking the churches, but if the churches wanted to offer something, they could. So you see how that works? And so that's been the official policy of the CIA in terms of evangelical Christians or missionaries for a long time. And so what you'll find is a lot of these church groups, they run anti-human trafficking organizations, yeah. right? Everybody's in the anti-human trafficking business.
I was just thinking, as I'm listening to you say this, I'm thinking, look, I don't want people to think that there's anything wrong with having a friendship with Israel or with Jewish Americans or with Israeli Jews or any of that. How did we get to the point where it wasn't just we have a respectful relationship with a country that's in the Middle East, which we believe had a democracy, to we have a exclusive relationship with this very tiny country in the Middle East. We give them hundreds of billions of dollars. We help fight their wars. We do as they say, oh, and we have to hate their enemies. Therefore, from now on in the United States, anyone who's Muslim is seen as a terrorist. Because that's what we basically have ended up with. And that's the part I think is horribly, horribly unfair. Because we should not judge any person based on their religion or their nationality or anything. And that's what we're doing on the behest of Israel, I think. You say what?
Well, I'd say that, September 11th happened, and that was probably the largest psychological operation ever waged on a populace, right?
Wow.
Because you had 17 Saudis. I think a handful of them were not Saudi. I think that they were, was there any Afghanis or Pakistanis? Regardless, all Muslim men were told that this man in a cave in Afghanistan directed these men to come to the U.S. to carry out this massive, complex, terrorist attack, which of course was in fact horrific. It's planned in Hamburg, Germany, but Afghanistan is where we get is where we invade.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They immediately retreat to Pakistan, which is, of course, a nuclear power at that point. So we can't go there. We can't invade in there. So we just set up base in Afghanistan for 20 years, trying to defeat the Taliban. But then we're also undoing. We're allowing the farmers to grow the opium again. That becomes a thing, right? There's so much going on there.
And then lo and behold, we end up, and I'll just add this and then let you finish what you were saying about. But then lo and behold, we also end up attacking Israel's biggest enemy, which is Saddam Hussein, and we blow up Iraq. Like, what a coincidence. And right?
Right. Yeah. We set up in Afghanistan. So we're able to kind of keep Pakistan at bay. Right. Cause we're occupying Afghanistan. Then we invade Iraq. Mm-hmm. We overthrow Gaddafi in Libya.
Yeah.
We take out, goodness gracious, Syria. What is his name?
Assad.
I'm blanking. Assad. Yeah. Assad. Yes. Yeah. And that's not to say that the people in those countries didn't have actual real struggles. I know Syria. I know that the people had, I'm not trying to like discount that or dismiss that. And that becomes another thing, right? Because there are people that were suffering under Saddam Hussein and under Gaddafi and under Assad. So it's not like their struggle isn't legitimate. It's just the problem is that like, I'm a firm believer that if it was a majority of the population, you actually don't need outside help that you actually can overthrow. If you've got 50 or 60% of the population wants this leader gone, then they're gone. That's just how it works.
But look at the steps the way you just took us through it. First, they got us to believe in something. Then they had an act that happened, we're not saying anything about it. But then they used that act to reinforce the negative thinking about a specific group of people. And then we started a series of attacks on the countries of those people, of which most Americans and everybody else in the Western world said, well, yeah, of course we have to attack those people. They're all radical, fanatical terrorists, you know? And it's like step one, step two, step three. Like, wow, that's smart.
Yep.
But evil.
And if you don't support these things, what is it? Because you want another 9/11 to happen? You I bet you will if another 9/11 happens.
And that's what we're hearing now. Kind of that's what we're hearing. Yep. Look at this. Show me Hegseth, Gene. Put up a shot of this guy, Hegseth. I mean, God bless him, as we say in North Carolina, but this guy is way over his skis. I mean, this guy with the frosted hair every morning, who used to do a very small weekend show on Fox News, is now running the biggest military in the world. And I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't think he knows what the hell he's talking about half the time. But here he is, you know, telling us what you just said. We got to kill these people because they want to come and kill us.
Right.
I mean.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that if that's your starting point, if that's what you think, well, then there's nothing you can't justify. Right.
Right.
We've always got to kill them before they kill us. It's this kind of paranoid thinking that really will justify any military action. Right.
That's dangerous and evil.
It's very dangerous. Yeah, yeah, there's 2 billion Muslims in the world. They are in every single country. So if the idea is that, quote unquote, radical Islam is the enemy, and of course, that's what the war on terror was, right? There's no defined boundaries of your of the conflict zone,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's literally the GWAT, the global war on terror. So it's the whole globe that we could potentially be at war with. And they put it in the name, you know? And and that's what we've been dealing with for 25 years now. And it has drained our treasury. It has demoralized the population. It has allowed foreign influence on a scale that's just really unimaginable, even just 50 years ago. I mean, if our founders could see today, I think that they probably would have balkanized and said, no, we can't allow this much resources and land under one government.
And it's all based on, you know, I was fortunate enough to have a journalistic experience of a lifetime. I was in Iran just days before the United States and Israel started the attacks and they bombed them. And I got to know the Iranian people. That they love Americans. They love our culture. They love Western culture. They're very nice people. Some of their leaders are screwed up and have made some mistakes, and I told them to their face, and they said, you're right. We wish we'd done some things differently. They did have, but you know, when you go around the world and you talk to the people that we're supposed to hate, another good example is Russia. You know, we're told since we're little kids by all the Hollywood movies that the Russians are really bad people. You go to Russia, they love America. They play our music. They want to drive our cars and sing our songs. And they're very Christian oriented and they're very good people, but we have to hate them and sanction them. Meanwhile, other countries that we have to love are basically kicking us in the teeth. It is such an ironic situation that I get to see from this part of the world that I wish my you know, that and people like you realize it because you read and you're smart, but I wish we could make more of our countrymen, more of our neighbors and friends understand these things somehow.
It's very frustrating because the brainwashing is so strong, right? Yeah. The with the boomers, unfortunately, the anti-communism brainwashing, it's just crazy. Oh wow, it's so intense. It really is. Which, okay, fine. Like, I'm not here to argue for or against communism. It's weird because it's like, would I say, oh, I'm a capitalist? But yeah. I think there's a lot of problems with capitalism.
Of course.
With the unchecked capitalism that we have.
Crony capitalism.
And which is all that we have. We have real crony capitalism.
And who the hell are we to tell anybody how they have to run their government? Let them make their mistakes. Heaven knows we've made plenty of ours. If every time we did something stupid, somebody came and hit us over the head with a sledgehammer, like we just saw an IDF soldier do to Jesus the other day, by the way, not for nothing. But, you know, then where would we be? We'd be in a hell of a pickle, too. Let people be who they are. Let them learn from the mistakes. Guide them. Negotiate with them. But this idea that you got to go everywhere and tell people how they have to think and it has to be like us, that's not Christian. Those aren't Christian values that this administration right now is pushing, as a matter of fact. At least not the Jesus that I was taught to believe in. For what it's worth, you know.
No, it's quite obviously driven by number one, a very small group of people who have a lot of financial incentive to not just that, but they're also very power hungry people. It's not just money; it is power, and power corrupts, right? And so that's what we're seeing. These people are godless, so power becomes their god.
Yes.
And money is their god, and this is, and when things like that, things that actually don't have real value, Mm-hmm. I mean, power has value, but money, not necessarily. You could just never get enough. It's insatiable. And that's mm-hmm. that's what we're dealing with all yeah. the time. People who have who are nihilistic, too. That's the other thing.
They're willing.
It's very dangerous to have people who don't believe in a higher power or anything greater than themselves at the helm. Because then they worship themselves.
I hate to say this, but I think you just described the president of the United States for what it's worth. And we'll leave it at that. But unfortunately, I think that is the case. And I think that is the Epstein class. And I think those Legos guys who are doing that have caught on to something that a lot of people are recognizing. And hopefully it can change. You, Mel, have been an absolute delight to talk to. I feel like we were sitting somewhere, you know, in a cafe in Fayetteville or someplace like that, having a conversation. Yeah. And it really has been wonderful. Thank you so much for the time.
Yes, thank you so much. Yes, thank you.
You've been so gracious, and it's great talking to you. And hopefully we'll do it again. We'll keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
There you go. So, hey, time for you now to get your say. First, on our map segment that I told you about a little while ago that we did the other day when there was the big breaking news in Iran, Asim Mahmood says, Rick always cuts through the noise, whether it's Iran, Trump, Xi, back channels, or whatever new chaos drops. Half the news is manufactured narrative. The other half is what people like Rick actually report on. Stay locked in. Whoa. A compliment for a change. Thank you, Mahmoud. Flash River says, wrong. Okay, see, this guy hates me. I just wonder if you will apologize for being wrong about Iran's so-called expansion when you see this was all a false assumption. I will do so happily, Mr. Flash, but somehow I don't think I'm going to have to. We'll see who's right. Nebulanexus says, Rick's turning an Iranian IRGC map into Iran now controls the Strait of Fujairah. Sorry. That's just his dramatic take on their latest paper release. No, Mr. Nexus, that's actually the reality of what's happening right now. And if you turn off Fox News or the BBC or CNN or the New York Times or wherever you're getting your information for just half a second, you too would understand that reality is actually in effect. As for my conversation about Germany yesterday with a former member of the Bundestag and how it's run by big money these days, especially BlackRock, this guy says, I can't read his name. My God, what the hell does that say? Let me try. Pantophobian says, hey, it is truly amazing to see democracy become such a scam. The election process bestows legitimacy to total liars. All over the democracies, people get effed up repeatedly and can do nothing about. Wow. Patriot Voice UK says, wow, what a change. Merce ran as a big, bad conservative savior against Merkelism and then immediately went open borders, endless Ukraine bank checks, and rearmament fever dream while Germans shiver in the dark and the bridges fall apart. Establishment gonna establish. Wow. Well said, Patriot Voice. You need a job as a writer? That's good. And Sanji says, it's a very good insight into German BlackRock connections. Do keep pressing such unfiltered data, Rick. True journalism. Well, thank you, sir. All right. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. You can check out our social media sites. It's on X, it's on Spotify, it's on BitChute. Thanks for being with us. We'll be looking for you again soon. And thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I am Rick Sanchez. And we'll see you again soon.